Welcome to this Uvula audio presentation of A Tramp Abroad by Mark Twain. Volume 7, Chapter 22, The Black Forest and Its Treasures. From Baden-Baden, we made the customary trip into the Black Forest. We were on foot most of the time. One cannot describe those noble woods nor the feeling with which they inspire him. A feature of the feeling, however, is a deep sense of contentment. Another feature is a buoyant, boyish gladness. And a third and very conspicuous feature of it is one's sense of the remoteness of the workday world and his entire emancipation from it and its affairs. Those woods stretch unbroken over a vast region, and everywhere they are such dense woods, and so still, and so piney, and so fragrant. The stems of the trees are trim and straight, and in many places all the ground is hidden for miles under a thick cushion of moss of a vivid green color, with not a decayed or ragged spot in its surface, and not a fallen leaf or twig to mar its immaculate tidiness. A rich cathedral gloom pervades the pillared aisles, so the stray flecks of sunlight that strike a trunk here and a bough yonder are strongly accented. And when they strike the moss, they fairly seem to burn. But the weirdest effect, and the most enchanting, is that produced by the diffused light of low afternoon sun. No single ray is able to pierce its way in. But the diffused light takes color from moss and foliage, and pervades the place like a faint, green-tinted mist, the theatrical fire of fairyland. The suggestion of mystery and the supernatural which haunts this forest at all times is intensified by this unearthly glow. We found the Black Forest farmhouses and villages, all that the Black Forest stories have pictured them. The first genuine specimen which we came upon was the mansion of a rich farmer and member of the common council of the parish or district. He was an important personage in the land, and so was his wife also, of course. His daughter was the catch of the region, and she may be already entering into immortality as the heroine of one of Auerbach's novels, for all I know. We shall see, for if he puts her in, I shall surely recognize her by her Black Forest clothes and her burned complexion, plump figure, fat hands, dull expression, gentle spirit, generous feet, bonnetless head, and the plaited tails of hemp-colored hair hanging down her back. The house was big enough for a hotel. It was 100 feet long and 50 feet wide, and 10 feet high from ground to eaves. But from the eaves to the comb of the mighty roof was as much as 40 feet, maybe more. The roof was of ancient mud-colored straw thatch, a foot thick. It was covered all over, except in a few trifling spots, with a thriving and luxurious growth of green vegetation, mainly moss. The mossless spots were places where repairs had been made by the insertion of bright new masses of yellow straw. The eaves projected far down like sheltering, hospitable wings. Across the gable that fronted the road, and about 10 feet above the ground, ran a narrow porch with a wooden railing. A row of small windows filled with very small panes looked out upon the porch. Above were two or three other little windows, one clear up under the sharp apex of the roof. Before the ground floor door was a huge pile of manure. The door of the second story room on the side of the house was open, and occupied by the rear elevation of a cow. Was this probably the drawing room? All the front half of the house from the ground up seemed to be occupied by people, cows, chickens, and all the rear half by draft animals and hay. But the chief feature all around this house were big heaps of manure. We became very familiar with the fertilizer in the forest. We fell unconsciously into the habit of judging of a man's station in life by his outward and eloquent sign. Sometimes we said, "Here is a poor devil." When we saw a stately accumulation of manure, however, we said, "Here is a banker." When we encountered a country seat surrounded by an alpine pampa manure, we said, "Well, doubtless a duke lives here." The importance of this feature has not been properly magnified in the Black Forest tales. Manure is evidently the Black Forester's main treasure, his coin, his jewel, his pride, his old master, his ceramics, his bric-a-brac, his darling, his title to public consideration, envy, veneration, and his first solicitude when he gets ready to make his will. The true Black Forest novel, if ever written, will be skeletoned somewhat in this way. The skeleton for a Black Forest novel. Rich old farmer named Huss has inherited great wealth of manure, and by diligence has added to it. It is double-starred in Baedeker. The Black Forest artist paints it, his masterpiece. The king comes to see it. Gretchen Huss, daughter and heiress. Paul Hoch, young neighbor, suitor to Gretchen's hand. Ostensibly, he really wants the manure. Hoch has a good many cartloads of the Black Forest currency himself, and therefore is a good catch. But he is sordid, mean, and without sentiment, whereas Gretchen is all sentiment and poetry. Hans Schmidt, young neighbor, full of sentiment, full of poetry, loves Gretchen. Gretchen loves him. But he has no manure. Old Huss forbids him in the house. His heart breaks. He goes away to die in the woods, far from the cruel world, for he says bitterly, "What is a man without manure?" Paul Hoch comes to old Huss and says, "I am at last as rich as you required. Come and view my pile." Old Huss views it and says, "It is sufficient. Take her and be happy," meaning Gretchen. Interval of 2 weeks. Wedding party assembled in old Huss's drawing room. Hoch, placid and content. Gretchen, weeping over her hard fate. Enter old Huss's head bookkeeper. Huss says fiercely, "I gave you 3 weeks to find out why your books don't balance. The time is up. Find me the missing property or you will go to prison as a thief." Bookkeeper, "I have found it." "Where?" Bookkeeper, sternly and tragically, "In the bridegroom's pile. Behold the thief. See him blench and tremble." Sensation. Paul Hoch. "Lost! Lost!" Falls over the cow in a swoon and is handcuffed. Gretchen. "Saved!" Falls over the calf in a swoon of joy, but is caught in the arms of Hans Schmidt, who springs in at that moment. Old Huss. "What? You here, varlet? Unhand the maid and quit this place." Hans, still supporting the insensible girl. "Never, cruel old man! Know that I come with claims which even you cannot despise." Huss. "What, you? Name them." Hans. "Listen then, the world has forsaken me. I forsook the world. I wandered in the solitude of the forest, longing for death but finding none. I fed upon roots, and in my bitterness I dug for the bitterest, loathing the sweeter kind. Digging 3 days agone, I struck a manure mine, a Golconda, a limitless bonanza of solid manure. I can buy you all now and have mountain ranges of manure left. Ha! Now thou smilest a smile." Immense sensation. Exhibition of specimens from the mine. Old Huss enthusiastically. "Wake her up! Shake her up! Noble young man, she is yours!" The wedding takes place on the spot. The bookkeeper is restored to his office and emoluments. Paul Hoch is led off to jail. The Bonanza King of the Black Forest lives to a good old age, blessed with the love of his wife and 27 children, and still sweeter envy of everybody about him. We took our noon meal of fried trout one day at the Plow Inn in a very pretty village, Otterhofen, and then went into the public room to rest and smoke. Then we found 9 or 10 Black Forest grandees assembled about the table. They were the common council of the parish. They had gathered there at 8 o'clock that morning to elect a new member, and they had now been drinking beer 4 hours at the new member's expense. They were men of 50 or 60 years of age with grave, good-natured faces, and were all dressed in the costume made familiar to us by the Black Forest stories. Broad, round-topped, black felt hats with the rims curled up all around, long red waistcoats with large metal buttons, and black alpaca coats with the waists up between the shoulders. There were no speeches, there was but little talk. There were no frivolities. The council filled themselves gradually, steadily, but surely with beer, and conducted themselves with sedate decorum, as became men of position, men of influence, men of manure. We had a hot afternoon tramp up the valley, along the grassy bank of a rushing stream of clear water, past farmhouses, water mills, and no end of wayside crucifixes and saints and virgins. These crucifixes, etc., are set up in memory of departed friends by survivors, and are almost as frequent as telegraph poles are in other lands. We followed the carriage road and had our usual luck. We traveled under a beating sun and always saw the shade leave the shady places before we could get to them. In all our wanderings, we seldom managed to strike a piece of road at its time for being shady. We had a particularly hot time of it on that particular afternoon, and with no comfort but what we could get out of the fact that the peasants at work away up on the steep mountainside above our heads were even worse off than we were. By and by it became impossible to endure the intolerable glare and heat any longer, so we struck across the ravine and entered the cool, deep twilight of the forest to hunt for what the guidebook called the Old Road. We found an old road, and it proved eventually to be the right one, though we followed it at the time with the conviction that it was the wrong one. If it was the wrong one, there could be no use in hurrying. Therefore, we did not hurry, but sat down frequently on the soft moss and enjoyed the restful quiet and shade of the forest solitudes. There had been distractions in the carriage road. School children, peasants, wagons, troops of pedestrianizing students from all over Germany. But we had the old road to ourselves. Now and then, while we rested, we watched the laborious ants at work. I found nothing new in them, certainly nothing to change my opinion of them. Seems to me that in the matter of intellect, the ant must be a strangely overrated bird. During many summers now, I have watched them, when I ought to have been in better business, and I have not yet come across a living ant that seemed to have any more sense than a dead one. I refer, of course, to the ordinary ant. I have had no experience of those wonderful Swiss and African ones which vote, keep drilled armies, hold slaves, and dispute about religion. Those particular ants may be all that the naturalist paints them, but I am persuaded that the average ant is a sham. I admit his industry, of course. He is the hardest working creature in the world, when anybody is looking. But his leather-headedness is the point I make against him. He goes out foraging, he makes a capture. Then what does he do? Go home? No. He goes anywhere but home. He doesn't know where home is. His home may only be 3 feet away. No matter, he can't seem to find it. He makes his capture, as I have said. It is generally something which can be of no sort of use to himself or anybody else. It is usually 7 times bigger than it ought to be. He hunts out the awkwardest place to take hold of it. He lifts it bodily up in the air by main force and starts, not toward home, but in the opposite direction. Not calmly and wisely, but with a frantic haste which is wasteful of his strength. He fetches up against a pebble, and instead of going around it, he climbs over it backwards, dragging his booty after him, tumbles down on the other side, jumps up in a passion, kicks the dust off his clothes, moistens his hands, grabs his property viciously, and yanks it this way and then that, shoves it ahead of him a moment, turns tail and lugs it after him another moment, gets madder and madder, then presently hoists it into the air and goes tearing away in an entirely different direction. If he comes to a weed, it never occurs to him to go around it. No, he's got to climb up it. And he climbs it, dragging his worthless property to the top, which is as bright a thing to do as it would be for me to carry a sack of flour from Heidelberg to Paris by way of Strasbourg steeple. When he gets up there, he finds that that is not the place. He takes a cursory glance at the scenery and either climbs down or tumbles down and starts off once more, as usual, in a new direction. At the end of half an hour, he fetches up within 6 inches of the place he started from and lays his burden down. Meanwhile, he has been all over the ground for 2 yards around, climbed all the weeds and pebbles he has come across. Now he wipes the sweat from his brow, strokes his limbs, and then marches aimlessly off in as violently a hurry as ever. He does not remember to have ever seen it before. He looks around to see which is not the way home, grabs his bundle, and starts. He goes through the same adventures he had before. Finally, he stops to rest, and a friend comes along. Evidently, the friend remarks that last year's grasshopper leg is a very noble acquisition and inquires where he got it. Evidently, the proprietor does not remember exactly where he got it, but he thinks he got it around here somewhere. Evidently, the friend contracts to help him freight it home. Then, with a judgment peculiarly antic, pun not intended, they take hold of opposite ends of that grasshopper leg and begin to tug with all their might in opposite directions. Presently, they take a rest and confer together. They decide that something is wrong. They can't make out what. Then they go at it again, just as before. Same result. Mutual recriminations follow. Evidently, each accuses the other of being an obstructionist. They lock themselves together and chew each other's jaws for a while, then roll and tumble on the ground till one loses a horn or a leg and has to haul off for repairs. They make up and go to work again in the same insane way, but the crippled ant is at a disadvantage now. Tug as he might, the other one drags off the booty and him at the end of it. Instead of just giving up, he hangs on and gets his shins bruised against every obstruction that comes in his way. By and by, when that grasshopper leg has been dragged all over the same old ground once more, it is finally dumped at about the spot where it originally lay. The two perspiring ants inspect it thoroughly and decide that dried grasshopper legs are a poor sort of property after all. Then each starts off in a different direction to see if he can't find an old nail or something else that is heavy enough to afford entertainment and at the same time valueless enough to make an ant want to own it. There in the black forest on the mountainside, I saw an ant go through with such a performance as this, with a dead spider of fully 10 times his own weight. The spider was not quite dead, but too far gone to resist. He had a round body the size of a pea. The little ant, observing that I was noticing, turned him on his back and sunk his fangs into his throat and lifted him into the air and started vigorously off with him, stumbling over little pebbles, stepping on the spider's legs and tripping himself up, dragging him backwards, shoving him bodily ahead, dragging him up stones 6 inches high instead of going around them, climbing weeds 20 times his own height and jumping from their summits, and finally leaving him in the middle of the road to be confiscated by any other fool of an ant that wanted him. I measured the ground with which this ass traversed and arrived at the conclusion that what he had accomplished inside of 20 minutes would constitute some such job as this, relatively speaking, for a man. To wit, to strap 2 800-pound horses together, carry them 1,800 feet, mainly over, not around boulders, averaging about 6 feet high, and in the course of that journey climb up and jump from the top of a precipice like Niagara and 3 steeples, each 120 feet high, and then put the horses down in an exposed place without anybody to watch them, and go off to indulge in some other idiotic miracle just for vanity's sake. Science has recently discovered that the ant does not lay up anything for winter use. This will knock him out of the literature to some extent. He does not work except when people are looking, and Only then, when the observer has a green naturalistic look and seems to be taking notes. This amounts to deception and will injure him for Sunday schools. He has not judgment enough to know what is good to eat from what isn't. This amounts to ignorance and will impair the world's respect for him. He cannot stroll around a stump and find his way home again. This amounts to idiocy, and once the damaging fact is established, thoughtful people will cease to look up to him. The sentimental will cease to fondle him. His vaunted industry is but a vanity and of no effect, since he never gets home with anything he starts with. This disposes of the last remnant of his reputation and wholly destroys his main usefulness as a moral agent, since it will make the sluggard hesitate to go to him any more. It is strange, beyond comprehension, that so manifest a humbug as the ant has been able to fool so many nations and keep it up so many ages without being found out. The ant is strong, but we saw another strong thing where we had not suspected the presence of much muscular power before. A toadstool. That vegetable which springs to full growth in a single night had torn loose and lifted a matted mass of pine needles and dirt twice its own bulk into the air, and supported it there, like a column supporting a shed. 10,000 toadstools with the right purchase could lift a man, I suppose, but what good would it do? All our afternoon's progress had been uphill. About 5 or 5:30, we reached the summit, and all of a sudden the dense curtain of the forest parted, and we looked down into a deep and beautiful gorge, and out over a wide panorama of wooded mountains, with their summits shining in the sun, and their glade-furrowed sides dimmed with purple shade. The gorge under our feet, called Allerheiligen, afforded room in the grassy level at its head for a cozy and delightful human nest, shut away from the world in its botherations, and consequently the monks of old times had not failed to spy that out. And here were the brown and comely ruins of their church and convent to prove that priests had as fine an instinct 700 years ago when ferreting out the choicest nooks and corners in a land as priests have today. A big hotel crowds the ruins a little now and drives a brisk trade with summer tourists. We descended into the gorge and had a supper which would have been very satisfactory if the trout had not been boiled. The Germans are pretty sure to boil a trout or anything else if left to their own devices. This is an argument of some value in support of the theory that they were the original colonists of the wild islands of the coast of Scotland. A schooner laden with oranges was wrecked upon one of those islands a few years ago, and the gentle savages rendered the captain such willing assistance that he gave them as many oranges as they wanted. Next day he asked them how they liked them. They shook their heads and said, "Baked, they were tough, and even boiled, they weren't things for a hungry man to hunker after." We went down the glen after supper. It is beautiful, a mixture of sylvan loveliness and craggy wilderness. A limpid torrent went whistling down the glen toward the foot of its winds through a narrow cleft between lofty precipices, and it hurls itself over a succession of falls. After one passes the last of these, he has a backward glimpse at the falls, which is very pleasing. They rise in a 7-stepped stairway of foamy and glittering cascades, and make a picture which is as charming as it is unusual. Chapter 23. Nicodemus Dodge and the Skeleton. We were satisfied that we could walk to Oppenau in one day, now that we were in practice. So we set out the next morning after breakfast, determined to do it. It was all downhill, and we had the loveliest summer weather for it. So we set the pedometer and then stretched away on an easy, regular stride, down through the cloven forest, drawing in the fragrant breath of the morning in deep, refreshing drafts, and wishing we might never have anything to do forever but to walk to Oppenau and keep on doing it, and then doing it over again. Now the true charm of pedestrianism does not lie in the walking or the scenery, but in talking. The walking is good to time the movement of the tongue by and to keep the blood and brain stirred up and active. The scenery and the woodsy smells are good to bear in upon a man, an unconscious and unobtrusive charm and solace to eye and soul and sense. But the supreme pleasure comes from the talk. It is no matter whether one talks wisdom or nonsense. The case is the same. The bulk of the enjoyment lies in the wagging of the gladsome jaw and the flapping of the sympathetic ear. And what motley variety of subjects a couple of people will casually rake over in the course of a day's tramp. There being no constraint, a change of subject is always in order, and so a body is not likely to keep pegging at a single topic until it grows tiresome. We discussed everything we knew during the first 15 or 20 minutes that morning, and then branched out into the glad, free, boundless realm of the things that we were not certain about. Harris said that if the best writer in the world once got the slovenly habit of doubling up his halves, he could never get rid of it while he lived. That is to say, if a man gets the habit of saying, "I should have liked to have known more about it," instead of simply saying, sensibly, "I should have liked to know more about it," the man's disease was incurable. Harris said that his sort of lapse is to be found in every copy of every newspaper that has ever been printed in English and in almost all of our books. He said he had observed it in Kirkham's Grammar and in Macaulay. Harris believed that milk teeth are commoner in men's mouth than those doubled-up halves. I do not know that there have not been moments in the course of the present session when I should have been very glad to have accepted the proposal of my noble friends and to have exchanged parts in some of our evenings of work. For example, from a speech of the English Chancellor of the Exchequer, August 1879. Quote, "I do not know that there have not been moments in the course of the present session when I should have been very glad to have accepted the proposal of my noble friend and to have exchanged parts in some of our evenings of work." Unquote. That changed the subject to dentistry. I said, I believe the average man dreaded tooth-pulling more than amputation, and that he would yell quicker under the former operation than he would under the latter. The philosopher Harris said that the average man would not yell in either case if he had an audience. Then he continued, "When our brigade first went into camp on the Potomac, we used to be brought up standing, occasionally by an ear-splitting howl of anguish. That meant that a soldier was getting a tooth pulled in a tent. But the surgeons soon changed that. They instituted open-air dentistry. There never was a howl afterwards, that is, from the man who was having the tooth pulled. At the daily dental hour, there would always be about 500 soldiers gathered together in the neighborhood of that dental chair, waiting to see the performance. And the moment the surgeon took a grip on the candidate's tooth and began to lift, every one of those 500 rascals would clap his hands to his jaw and begin to hop around on one leg and howl with all the lungs he had. It was enough to raise your hair to hear that variegated and enormous unanimous caterwaul bursting out. With so big and derisive an audience as that, a sufferer wouldn't emit a sound though you pulled his head off. Surgeons said that pretty often a patient was compelled to laugh in the midst of his pangs, but that they had never caught one crying out after the open-air exhibition was instituted. Dental surgeons suggested doctors. Doctors suggested death. Well, death suggested skeletons, and so on. And so, by logical process, the conversation melted out of one of these subjects and into the next, until the topic of skeletons raised up Nicodemus Dodge out of the deep grave of my memory. There he had lain buried and forgotten for 25 years. When I was a boy in a printing office in Missouri, a loose-jointed, long-legged, toe-headed, jeans-clad, countrified cub of about 16 lounged in one day, and without removing his hands from the depths of his trouser pockets, or taking off his faded ruin of a slouch hat, whose broken rim hung limp and ragged about his eyes and ears like a bug-eaten cabbage leaf, stared indifferently around, and then leaned his hip against the editor's table, crossed his mighty brogans, aimed at a distant fly from a crevice in his upper teeth, laid him low, and said with composure, "Why, here's the boss." "I am the boss," said the editor, following this curious bit of architecture wonderingly along up its clock face with his eye.
"Don't want anybody fur to learn the business? 'Tain't likely."
"Well, I don't know. Would you like to learn the business?"
"I'm so poor it can't run me no more. So I want to get a show summers if I can. 'Tain't no difference what. I'm strong and hearty, and I don't turn my back on no kind of work, hard nor soft."
"You think you might like to learn the printing business?"
"Well, I don't really care or darn what I do learn, so I get a chance for to make my way. I just as soon learn printing as anything."
"Can you read?"
"Yeah, middling."
"Can you write?"
"Well, I'd seen people could lay over me there."
"Can you cipher?"
"Not good enough to keep store, I don't reckon. Up as fur as 12 times 12, I ain't no slouch. T'other side of that is what gets me."
"Where's your home?"
"I'm from Old Shelby."
"What's your father's religious denomination?"
"Him? Oh, he's a blacksmith."
No, I don't mean his trade. What's his religious denomination?"
"Oh, I didn't understand you before. He's a Freemason."
No, you don't get my meaning yet. What I mean is, does he belong to any church?"
"Now you're talking. Couldn't make out what you were trying to get through. Belong to a church? Why, boss, he been the pissinest kind of free will Baptist 40 years. There ain't no pissiner one. What he is, mighty good man, Pap is. Everybody says that. If they said any different, they wouldn't say it where I was."
"What is your own kind of religion?"
"Well, boss, you kind of got me there, and you ain't got me mighty much neither. I think 'tis if a feller helps another feller when he's in trouble and don't cuss and don't know mean things, nor nothing he ain't no business to do, and don't spell the Savior's name with a little G, he ain't running no rests. He's about as safe as belong to a church."
"But suppose he did spell it with a little G, what then?"
"Well, if he done it a purpose, I reckon he wouldn't stand no chance. He oughtn't to have no chance anyway. I'm most rotten certain about that."
"What's your name, sir?"
"Nicodemus Dodge."
"I think maybe you'll do, Nicodemus. We'll give you a trial anyway."
"All right."
"When would you like to begin?"
"Now?"
So within 10 minutes after we had first glimpsed this nondescript person, he was one of us and with his coat off and hard at it. Beyond that end of our establishment, which was furthest from the street, was a deserted garden, pathless and thickly grown with the bloomy and villainous jimson weed and its common friend, the stately sunflower. In the midst of this mournful spot was a decayed and aged little frame house with but one room, one window, and no ceiling. It had been a smokehouse a generation before. Nicodemus was given this lonely and ghostly den as a bedchamber. The village smarties recognized a treasure in Nicodemus right away, that is, a butt to play jokes on. It was easy to see that he was inconceivably green and confiding. George Jones had the glory of perpetrating the first joke on him. He gave him a cigar with a firecracker in it and winked to the crowd to come. The thing exploded presently and swept away the bulk of Nicodemus's eyebrows and eyelashes, and he said simply,
"I consider them kind of cigars dangersome,"
and seemed to suspect nothing. Next evening, Nicodemus waylaid George and poured a bucket of ice water over him. One day, while Nicodemus was in swimming, Tom Elroy tied his clothes. Nicodemus made a bonfire of Tom's by retaliation. A third joke was played upon Nicodemus a day or two later. He walked up the middle aisle of the village church Sunday night with a staring handbill pinned between his shoulder blades. The joker spent the remainder of the night after church in the cellar of a deserted house, and Nicodemus sat on the cellar door till toward breakfast time to make sure that the prisoner remembered that if any noise was made, some rough treatment would be in consequence. The cellar had 2 feet of stagnant water in it and was bottomed with 6 inches of soft mud. But I wander from the point. It was the subject of skeletons that brought this boy back to my recollection. Before a very long time had elapsed, the village smarties began to feel uncomfortable consciousness of not having made a very shining success out of their attempts at the simpleton from Old Shelby. Experimenters grew scarce and chary, and now the young doctor came to the rescue. There was delight and applause when he proposed to scare Nicodemus to death and explained how he was going to do it. He had a noble new skeleton, the skeleton of the late and only local celebrity, Jimmy Finn, the town drunkard, a grisly piece of property which had been bought of Jimmy Finn himself at auction for $50 under great competition, when Jimmy lay very sick in the tan yard a fortnight before his death. The $50 had gone promptly for whiskey and had considerably hurried up the change of ownership of the skeleton. The doctor would put Jimmy Finn's skeleton in Nicodemus's bed. This was done about 10:30 in the evening. About Nicodemus's usual bedtime, midnight, the village jokers came creeping stealthily through the jimson weed and sunflowers toward the lonely frame den. They reached the window and peeped in. There sat the long-legged pauper in his bed, in a very short shirt, and nothing more. He was dangling his legs contentedly back and forth and wheezing the music of Camptown Races out over a paper overlaid comb, which he was pressing against his mouth. By him lay a new jew's harp, a new top, and solid india rubber ball, a handful of painted marbles, 5 pounds of store candy, and a well-gnawed slab of gingerbread as big and thick as a volume of sheet music. He had sold the skeleton to a traveling quack for $3, and he was enjoying the result. Just as we had finished talking about skeletons and were drifting into the subject of fossils, Harris and I heard a shout and glanced up the steep hillside. We saw men and women standing away up there looking frightened, and there was a bulky object tumbling and floundering down the steep slope toward us. We got out of the way, and when the object landed in the road, it proved to be a boy. He had tripped and fallen, and there was nothing for him to do but trust to luck and take what might come. When one rolls down a place like that, there is no stopping till the bottom is reached. Think of people farming on a slant which is so steep that the best you can say of it, if you want to be fastidiously accurate, is that it is a little steeper than a ladder and not quite so steep as a mansard roof. But that is what they do. Some of the little farms on the hillside opposite Heidelberg were stood up edgewise. The boy was wonderfully jolted up, and his head was bleeding from cuts which it had gotten from small stones on the way. Harris and I gathered him up and set him on a stone. By that time, the men and women had scampered down and brought his cap. Men, women, and children flocked out from neighboring cottages and joined the crowd. The pale boy was petted and stared at and commiserated with, and water was brought for him to drink and bathe his bruises in. And there was such a clatter of tongues. All who had seen the catastrophe were describing the scene at once, and each trying to talk louder than his neighbor. And one youth of a superior genius ran a little way up the hill, called attention, tripped, fell, rolled down among us, and thus triumphantly showed exactly how the thing had been done. Harris and I were included in all the descriptions. How we were coming along, how Hans Gross shouted, how we looked up startled, how we saw Peter coming like a cannon shot, how judiciously we got out of the way and let him come, and with what presence of mind we picked him up and brushed him off and set him on a rock, when the performance was over. We were as much heroes as anybody else, except Peter, and were so recognized. We were taken with Peter and the populace to Peter's mother's cottage, and there we ate bread and cheese and drank milk and beer with everybody else and had a most sociable good time. And when we left, we had a handshake all around and were receiving and shouting back Leibwohls until a turn in the road separated us from our cordial and kindly new friends forever. We accomplished our undertaking at 8:30 in the evening. We stepped into Oppenau, just 11 hours and a half out of Allerheiligen, 146 miles. Well, this is the distance by pedometer. The guidebook and the Imperial Ordnance maps make it at only 10 and a quarter. That's a surprising blunder, for these two authorities are usually singularly accurate in the matter of distances.